About 2,700 to 2,400 BC reigned five emperors who seem to have been almost incredibly exemplary beings. There follows, upon these first five emperors, a series of dynasties, of which the accounts become more and more exact and convincing as they become more recent. China has to tell a long history of border warfare and of graver struggles between the settled and nomad peoples. To begin with, China, like Sumer and like Egypt, was a land of city-states. The government was at first a government of numerous kings. They became loosely feudal under an emperor, as the Egyptians did. And then later, as with the Egyptians, came a centralizing empire. Shang, 1750 to 1125 BC, and Chu, 1125 to 250 BC, are named as being the two great dynasties of the feudal period. Bronze vessels of these earlier dynasties, beautiful, splendid, and with a distinctive style of their own, still exist, and there can be no doubt of the existence of a high state of culture, even before the days of Shang. It's perhaps a sense of symmetry that made the later historians of Egypt and China talk of the earlier phases of their national history as being under dynasties comparable to the dynasties of the later empires, and of such early emperors as Menes in Egypt, or the first five emperors in China. The early dynasties exercised far less centralized powers than the later ones. Such unity as China possessed under the Shang dynasty was a religious rather than an effective political union. The Son of Heaven offered sacrifices for all the Chinese. There was a common script, a common civilization, and a common enemy in the Huns of the northwestern borders. The last of the Shang dynasty was a cruel and foolish monarch who burnt himself alive, 1125 BC, in his palace, after a decisive defeat by Wu Wang, the founder of the Chu dynasty. Wu Wang seems to have been helped by allies from among the southwestern tribes, as well as by a popular revolt. For a time, China remained loosely united under the Chu emperors, as loosely united as was Christendom under the popes in the Middle Ages. The Chu emperors had become the traditional high priests of the land in the place of the Shang dynasty, and claimed a sort of overlordship in Chinese affairs. But gradually, the loose ties of usage and sentiment that held the empire together lost their hold upon men's minds. Hunnish peoples to the north and west took on the Chinese civilization without acquiring a sense of its unity. Feudal princes began to regard themselves as independent. Mr. Liang Chuqiao, one of the Chinese representatives at the Paris Conference of 1919, states that between the 8th and 4th centuries BC, there were, in the Huanghe and Yangtze valleys, no less than 5,000 or 6,000 small states, with about a dozen powerful states dominating over them. The land was subjected to perpetual warfare, age of confusion. In the 6th century BC, the great powers of conflict were Qi and Qin, which were northern Huanghe states, and Zhou, which was a vigorous, aggressive power in the Yangtze Valley. The confederation against Zhou laid the foundation for a league that kept the peace for 100 years. The league subdued and incorporated Zhou and made a general treaty of disarmament. It became the foundation of a new Pacific empire. The knowledge of iron entered China at some unknown date, but iron weapons began to be commonly used only about 500 BC, that's to say 200 or 300 years or more after this had become customary in Assyria, Egypt, and Europe. Iron was probably introduced from the north into China by the Huns. The last rulers of the Chu dynasty were ousted by the kings of Qin. The latter seized upon the sacred sacrificial bronze tripods, and so were able to take over the imperial duty of offering sacrifices to heaven. In this manner was the Qin dynasty established. It ruled with far more vigor and effect than any previous family. The reign of Shi Huang Ti, meaning first universal emperor of this dynasty, is usually taken to mark the end of feudal and divided China. He seems to have played the unifying role in the East that Alexander the Great might have played in the West, but he lived longer, and the unity he made, or restored, was comparatively permanent, while the empire of Alexander the Great fell to pieces, as we shall tell, at his death. Shi Huang Ti, among other feats in the direction of common effort, organized the building of the Great Wall of China against the Huns. A civil war followed close upon his reign and ended in the establishment of the Han dynasty. Under this Han dynasty, the empire grew greatly beyond its original two river valleys. The Huns were effectively restrained, and the Chinese penetrated westward until they began to learn at last of civilized races and civilizations other than their own. By 100 BC, the Chinese had heard of India. Their power had spread across Tibet and into western Turkestan, and they were trading by camel caravans with Persia and the Western world. So much for the present must suffice for our account of China. We shall return to the distinctive characters of its civilization later. Sixth, and in these thousands of years, during which man was making his way step by step from the barbarism of the Heliolithic culture to civilization at these old world centers, what was happening in the rest of the world? To the north of these centers, from the Rhine to the Pacific, the Nordic and Mongolian peoples, as we've told, were also learning the use of metals. But while the civilizations were settling down, these men of the Great Plains were becoming migratory and developing from a slow, wandering life towards a complete seasonal nomadism. To the south of the civilized zone, in central and southern Africa, the Negro was making a slower progress, and that, it would seem, under the stimulus of invasion by whiter tribes from the Mediterranean regions, bringing with them in succession cultivation and the use of metals. These white men came to the black by two routes, across the Sahara to the west as Berbers and Tuaregs and the like, to mix with the Negro and create such quasi-white races as the Fulas, and also by way of the Nile, where the Buganda, Ganda folk of Uganda, for example, may possibly be of remote white origin. The African forests were denser then and spread eastward and northward from the Upper Nile. The islands of the East Indies, 3,000 years ago, were probably still only inhabited here and there by stranded patches of Paleolithic Australoids, who had wandered thither in those immemorial ages when there was a nearly complete land bridge by way of the East Indies to Australia. The islands of Oceania were uninhabited. The spreading of the Heliolithic peoples by sea-going canoes into the islands of the Pacific came much later in the history of man, at earliest 1,000 years B.C. Still later did they reach Madagascar. The beauty of New Zealand also was as yet wasted upon mankind. Its highest living creatures were a great ostrich-like bird, the moa, now extinct, and the little kiwi, which has feathers like coarse hair, and the merest rudiments of wings. In North America, a group of mongoloid tribes were now cut off altogether from the old world. They were spreading slowly southward, hunting the innumerable bison of the plains. They had still to learn for themselves the secrets of a separate agriculture based on maize, and in South America to tame the llama to their service and so build up in Mexico and Peru two civilizations roughly parallel in their nature to that of Sumer, but different in many respects, and later by 6,000 or 7,000 years. When men reached the southern extremity of America, the Megatherium, the giant sloth, and the Glyptodon, the giant armadillo, were still living. There's a considerable imaginative appeal in the obscure story of the early American civilizations. It was largely a separate development. Some when, at last, the southward drift of the Amerindians must have met and mingled with the eastward canoe-borne drift of the Heliolithic culture. But it was the Heliolithic culture, still at a very lowly stage and probably before the use of metals. It has to be noted as evidence of this canoe-borne origin of American culture that elephant-headed figures are found in Central American drawings. American metallurgy may have arisen independently of the Old World use of metal, or it may have been brought by these elephant carvers. These American peoples got to the use of bronze and copper, but not to the use of iron. They had gold and silver, and their stonework, their pottery, weaving, and dyeing were carried to a very high level. In all these things, the American product resembles the Old World product generally. But always it has characteristics that are distinctive. The American civilizations had picture writing of a primitive sort, but it never developed even to the pitch of the earliest Egyptian hieroglyphics. In Yucatan only was there a kind of script, the Maya writing, but it was used simply for keeping a calendar. In Peru, the beginnings of writing were superseded by a curious and complicated method of keeping records by means of knots tied upon strings of various colors and shapes. It's said that even laws and orders could be conveyed by this code. These string bundles were called quipus, but though quipus are still to be found in collections, the art of reading them is altogether lost. Chinese histories, Mr. L. Y. Chen informs us, state that a similar method of record by knots was used in China before the invention of writing there. The Peruvians also got to making maps and the use of counting frames, but with all this, there was no means of handing on knowledge and experience from one generation to another, nor was anything done to fix and summarize these intellectual possessions, which are the basis of literature and science. When the Spaniards came to America, the Mexicans knew nothing of the Peruvians, nor the Peruvians of the Mexicans. Intercourse there was none. Whatever links had ever existed were lost and forgotten. The Mexicans had never heard of the potato, which was a principal article of the Peruvian diet. In 5000 B.C., the Sumerians and Egyptians probably knew as little of one another. American was 6000 years behind the Old World.